This morning, our speaker is Reverend Denise Gouch. We welcome Reverend Gouch to UUFM once each month. Reverend Denise came to Unitarian Universalism by way of a Roman Catholic youth in a military family and a young adulthood spent at Vanderbilt University, where she almost completed a doctorate in historical theology, but she had a bit more fun managing the Divinity School bookstore. She has been on staff at First UU Church of Nashville since 2005, serving as membership coordinator. Denise earned her Master of Divinity degree from Vanderbilt University in 2011, and she was ordained to the UU ministry jointly by the First UU Nashville and the UU Church of Huntsville, Alabama in 2015. Her primary passion these days is looking for ways to support the growth of Unitarian Universalism in Middle Tennessee and the Southern region. Reverend Denise will speak on the topic, Learning to Be at Home, Spiritual Practice and Social Praxis. Let's welcome Reverend Denise.
So wonderful to be here again with y'all this morning. Did it rain down here all day yesterday? Before I dig in, because, you know, you can't have too many monster stories, I have another monster story for you. This one's maybe a little more grown up. Maybe not. It comes from a book entitled Belonging to Life, The Journey of Awakening by Mary O'Malley. And I just think it's so brilliant. I'm going to mostly read it, but I'll adapt a little bit as I go. Imagine coming home one day to find a monster sitting in the middle of your living room. "What are you doing here?" you say with great indignation. You get no response, so you're feeling a little irritated, and you order that monster out of your house. He doesn't move. So you run into the kitchen, and you ask the other people in your family, what's this intruder doing in our living room? And they know, nobody has a clue. So you return to the living room, you announce that you are going to call the police, and he still does not respond. Calling 911, you say, "This is an emergency. A monster has moved into my house, and I want you to take him away." Kindly but firmly, they tell you that this is not their job. You call social services, moving companies, and even the zoo, hoping to get rid of this unwanted guest. Nothing works. Being a good student of consciousness-raising practices, you decide that since you create your reality, he is only here because you have not figured something out. So, off to counseling you go. You describe this stranger in your living room, and the counselor takes you back into childhood, discovering a trauma there. You let go of a big chunk of self-judgment, and with a sense of relief, you go home, fully expecting that the monster will be gone. It isn't. So, now you decide that it was bad karma from a past life. Off you go to be regressed and discover a life where you were the underdog, and the monster represents all of the people who persecuted you. This begins to make sense. This understanding brings deeper layers of mercy, and again, with great hope, you enter the living room only to discover that the monster is still there. The sense that he would be gone if only you could figure it all out and understand how to do this right begins to eat at your heart. The edges of despair flood your being, but with great strength, you resolve that you will just try harder, and then it will just have to work. Everything you've done so far has made it easier for you to live with him, but you still want the monster gone from the living room. Thinking that you are responsible for everything, you close your eyes and say powerful affirmations, repeating to yourself over and over again, "I am healed and this irritant is gone from my life." You feel more empowered as you say these words, and you know that he is evaporating right now as you speak. In a very confident move, you take a peek through your eyes, only to discover that he is still there. So you call on your friends, they come, they do a healing circle, cleansing your house with sage and cedar and visualizing white light surrounding and transforming this unwanted guest. The atmosphere in the house is much lighter, and it's clearer, but he isn't gone. As your friends leave, they assure you all you have to do is continue this practice, these practices, and eventually he will leave. After all, they remind you, you are in charge of your life. Then, after a particularly rigorous week of counseling, affirming, and visualizing, it begins to sink into your consciousness that maybe he isn't going to leave. If that is the case, you say, I will at least make him more presentable. You call in a barber and a fashion designer to spiffy him up. And it does become a little easier to live with him. He's not quite as scary and abhorrent. But one morning, sitting on the couch and doing all of the varied practices that promise to get rid of this uncomfortable visitor, the feelings of deep grief and rage at yourself begin to overwhelm you. If I create my reality, then I am a failure. Nobody else has a monster in their living room. They all do, but they never speak about it. And if I can't get rid of my monster, there must be something terribly wrong with me. You collapse on the floor in a flood of tears, self-judgment, and hopelessness. In the middle of this storm, you hear, very faintly, a melodious voice. Ask me why I am here. In shock, you look up at the monster. In this whole time, he's never spoken before. What did you say? You ask in amazement. Ask me why I'm here, he repeats. Well, I don't want to talk to you. You're the enemy. I didn't invite you here in my home. You came unbidden and are deeply unwelcome. In a huff, you turn your back to him. What have you got to lose, he asks. Nothing else has worked. I haven't gone away. In your desperation, you realize that this is true. Picking yourself up out of the heap of self-failure, you slowly approach him. Your heart is racing wildly. This is the enemy. What am I doing? I must be crazy. But your desperation urges you on. As you sit down in a chair across from him, you become curious. And the first thing you notice when you look at him is that the monster has kind eyes. Why, you have beautiful eyes, you say, and they're even twinkling with joy and laughter. Why haven't I noticed that before? Because you made me the enemy, he says in his melodious and healing voice. I am not your enemy. I have come from the depths of your being into your life in order to awaken you. I am not here to disturb you, even though I do evoke that in your mind. I am not here to harm you, even though I do bring up your fear. If you listen to that which is upsetting in your life, it will teach you that there is no there that you need to get to. No mythical place where everything will finally be fixed, understood, managed, and controlled. The healing is in learning how to show up for the dance exactly as it is appearing. In some corner of your being, you know that what he says is true. Rather than wanting to run away, you begin to listen to this monster, and your heart begins to melt. The words he speaks are true, and they quiet the racing of your mind and open the fist around your heart. As you drink from the nectar of truth, fear begins to take over again. This is so beautiful and so right that I am afraid I will forget, you say. I am afraid I will make you the enemy again. You will, he says, but that is okay. So I have a sermon about one of my monsters. And this involves something of a confession on my part. I know the introduction, we're going to have to rewrite that introduction, I think, because when I started coming here last winter, I was still on staff in Nashville, but I'm not anymore. I resigned that job. But as you may or may not know about me, I did work for another Unitarian Universalist congregation for some years as their membership coordinator. In that role, it was my job to work with the membership committee to oversee our welcome to one and all, especially on Sunday mornings. By the way, if you're interested in being more engaged in that sort of work, I'm sure someone here, maybe Jill, could help you get connected. Someone would love to help you find a way to contribute with setup and greeting people. It was, at this other congregation, my job to be welcoming and to help the congregation collectively think about how they welcome others. Usually, this was a joy, but sometimes I felt, and I still feel sometimes, afraid. I have been afraid or hesitant or resistant, usually without knowing precisely why, and it's often when we are or have been considering the topic of diversity. Every Sunday in UU congregations, our lay leaders say something like, you know, in Nashville, they say, if you are looking for a spiritual home, we hope that you may find it here. Here in Murfreesboro, you say, we welcome you. It would be our great honor if you make our UU fellowship your home. All are welcome here. We UU say these things of greeting, and I think we really do mean those words. UU congregations and our association of congregations speak of our commitment to welcome all who are in sympathy with our values, without regard to the traits that sometimes divide folks. And we institutionalize that commitment to inclusion in our leadership development for both professional and volunteer leaders, our religious education programming, and our social justice work. The first and second of our shared principles affirm the worth and dignity of every person and the value of justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. And that often, and quite rightly, makes us feel proud to be Unitarian Universalist. And yet, when we look around, we know our congregations and our UUA do not enjoy the diversity they could, and we struggle with why that is so and what it means about us. I suspect the fear that gets triggered in me when we talk about diversity is basically a fear that somehow I am not doing or thinking or understanding things correctly, and I don't know what to do with that. How can it be that we can have a pretty darn sophisticated understanding of the social forces at work in our world and still be unable to escape or adequately mitigate their consequences? How can we have such good hearts, and I really do believe that we are a big-hearted people, and still fail to connect with others and live consistently in right relationship? It's a puzzle I can't quite solve, so sometimes I walk around with the sense that I'm not quite, quite right or good enough somehow, and it bugs me. And I suspect the welcome I can offer when I'm in that place in my head is not perhaps quite as joyful or open or welcoming as we might hope, which is just more proof of my not quite good enoughness. And at this point, with my fear that there is something more that I should be doing or analyzing, controlling, or adjusting, but which I can't quite put my finger on, there is quite a party of monsters in my living room. I've been pondering this feeling and observing it in other UUs around me for some time now. I'm quite sure that feeling this way is counterproductive to creating the world of which we dream. But I just couldn't find a way to cut through those feelings for myself until I read something in an email from the UUSC a few years ago. Many of you know that the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee is a nonprofit organization dedicated to working worldwide for human rights and social justice. If you don't know that they regularly send out colorful and joyful email updates on their work, I suggest you check out their website. One of those UUSC newsletters carried an article about the gala that this organization hosted at the 2012 Justice General Assembly in Phoenix, Arizona, at which Anita Hill was quoted as saying this: "Real equality boils down to whether or not we feel at home, whether we belong and are valued." I read that sentence and I thought, huh. Real equality, serious equality, one of our treasured values, as understood by one of the top-notch legal minds of our age, not about numbers and percentages being correct, not about vaunted principles, not even particularly objective. It boils down to a homely feeling, a feeling we all think of as ordinary, an individual lived experience of something pretty basic to human existence and survival. Who'd have thought? It seems too easy. And then I thought about the feeling of being at home and my experiences of belonging and knowing myself to be valued. Ouch. I don't want to overgeneralize, but I think I'm safe in saying that all of us feel very much not at home sometimes, no matter who we are or how well we've been loved or how like or unlike others we perceive ourselves to be. In fact, I have often argued that our culture, especially our economy, is based on keeping us from feeling at home. Take, for example, the pervasiveness of advertising, which depends on creating anxiety. In order to be effective, ads must convince us that we ourselves, or the circumstances in which we find ourselves, are lacking something which we can go out and purchase to fix our problem. Unlike other older cultures, Northern Euro-American culture is largely made up of the descendants of immigrants and refugees, and the Industrial Revolution on our continent created an economy that requires an unrooted mobile workforce. We grow up, also, in a culture with deep tendencies toward mind-body dualism, in which we are taught to distrust or control our bodies and our emotions and to overvalue our cognitive selves. We also tend to believe that competition and scarcity are the truth of our existence, despite alternative stories about cooperation and abundance. Perhaps because the powers that be find it easier to control and exploit our fears than our strengths. My list could go on. This is a list of ways we don't feel at home, but I think you probably get the point. Pretty much, no matter who we are or where we come from, our sense of being at home with our bodies, our emotions, and ourselves is liable to have taken a battering in the course of everyday life. I did not attend the gala at which Hill spoke, but I'm pretty sure she meant to focus our attention on the injustice and inequality marking the experience of the many disenfranchised groups and individuals whose daily experiences deliver pointed reminders that they are not welcome, are not valued, and are not invited to make themselves at home. I'm pretty sure I was being called in this speech to consider what I might do to extend the welcome of Unitarian Universalism farther and farther and farther yet. But I read this sentence and felt a bit defeated, and at the same time, strangely and profoundly released. Defeated by the thought that I, as a partaker in a number of social privileges, was being asked to share something on which I have only a very tenuous grasp some days, yet also freed by the realization that it is really, really difficult to give to others what you do not have. Perhaps those of us who are relatively less disenfranchised clench internally when we are asked to openly, freely welcome folks who seem to be other or different, to invite them to feel at home, precisely because we are being asked to share a feeling of home that we do not experience enough ourselves. Especially if we have, probably unconsciously, harbored the idea that good things are scarce and sharing could deplete precious reserves. In the light of day, after a bit of deep breathing, maybe looking, seeing the monster has kind eyes, it's a little easier to recognize that the feeling of being at home is not a commodity that can be depleted. Hill's words suggest that we, any of us, need to learn to feel at home, to know what it is to be valued and respected, and to understand belonging in order to bring our best contributions to the quest for social justice. We may have picked up the idea that spiritual practice and social justice work are separate from each other or oriented in different directions, but they are not. Spiritual practice and its attention to the self is not an escape from the world or a release from our responsibility to live in justice and compassion. Rather, it provides training in the attention that grounds effective action. It creates a space in which we find the courage, patience, and strength to return again and again and again and again to our values and our commitments. On the flip side, social justice is not something we do for others. It is a way to live into our deepest values, to remember who and what we are, to honor the unity of existence that is more real than the ideas of separation we have been encouraged to accept. In attending to our relationships with the rest of the human family and the rest of existence, in giving life the shape of justice, we come home to ourselves. There are a thousand ways to be different, to be or to feel excluded, and a thousand things that can get in the way of feeling at home. The good news, and I think it is quite powerfully the good news of Unitarian Universalism, implicit in our seven principles, is that we already are at home. Each and every one of us has value and dignity. We all deserve equity and compassion. And we are foundationally connected not only to each other, but to every part of the web of all existence. Insofar as we you use can make statements about our beliefs, that's what we believe. That is the good news we have to share, the ground upon which we stand in our quest to transform ourselves and the world. The trick is to unhook our fearful brains and learn to experience what really is, to know who we are, what we are, the home from which we are born and reborn again. Another bit of good news, there are 1,000,000 ways to learn to be at home, 1,000,000 ways to prepare ourselves to bless our monsters and welcome others. We all long for a sense of home and belonging, and we all have monsters, whether encountered in our living rooms or, as in Frank's story, out on the caravan route. You will have heard this before, but as far as I can tell, the point of every spiritual discipline among the vast array found in human religious practice boils down to learning this. Be aware in the present moment. Be here now. Accept what is. Wise stories from many traditions teach us that truly being awake and attentive to reality in a way that fosters compassion instead of fear opens up a realm of possibilities in our deeds and relationships that not only saves us, but also transforms the world. In the words of Jesus, the truth shall set you free. In Sham's story of the monster in the well, being awake and present in the moment allows the wise man to respond to the monster with compassion and dignity, which not only saves his own life, but brings freedom for the captives and water for a dry land. Not a bad payoff for learning to stop our headlong rush through life and breathe. At this point, you might notice we've ended up in what some people would consider strange territory. Basically, I am suggesting that enlightenment and being at home are the same thing. As Rumi puts it, because I'm going to, another Rumi quote you might want for your Facebook, because, you know, quoting Rumi is never ever a good way to, I mean, never ever is, it's never a bad way to frame a sermon. From the poem, The Self We Share, but look, fish, you're already in the ocean. Just swimming there makes you friends with glory. Amen. Let's go home.